Hey, what's up? This is episode 120, Topical Zoom. I know you build products, but then when you do that, what do you focus on? Do you focus on the problem space or the solution space? Or perhaps there is yet another dimension to it. Let's do it. 1, 2, 3.
Welcome to the Design Your Thinking Podcast, a show where we think, learn, and explore the product mindset so you can design better products every day. And now your host, Karthik.
Hey there, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining me again today on the Design Your Thinking Podcast. This is me, Karthik, and I'm so excited to have you back. All right, let's jump into today's topic. It's about problem space versus solution space. As someone who's making products, I've been asked this question multiple times, and I've ended up giving advice on why you should be focusing on the problem space or in the problem space multiple times. But I thought we should actually have a discussion around this. Now, it wouldn't be really good to have a discussion just around this topic. So I invited someone who can talk about problem space versus solution space. And you know what he did? He introduced a third dimension to it. And I just can't wait to share that with you. So the conversation that I had with our guest today went on for over an hour. So I had to, you know, clip it to two episodes, this one and the one to follow, which comes out on Wednesday. All right, so let's jump right into today's conversation. But I had to tell you something. If you are not driving or doing anything that requires your complete attention, if you're safe from any of these activities, just head over to designyourthinking.com/insider. Just type that in your browser, in your iPhone or Android phone or your computer. And that will take you to DYT Insider. That's my newsletter. Just type in your first name and your email address. And I would love to see you every once in a while with something interesting around user-centric products. All right. Let's now jump right back into our conversation here with our guest, who's someone who has 2 decades of experience with user-centric design. He helps companies to think and act strategically when innovating with user insights. Based outside San Francisco, he is principal of Portugal Consulting and the author of 2 books. The classic, Interviewing Users, How to Uncover Compelling Insights, and the new one called Doorbells, Danger, and Dead Batteries, User Research War Stories. He's also the host of Dollars to Donuts podcast, where he interviews people who lead user research in their organizations. All right, let's jump right into the show and let's talk to Steve. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to be fun. So Steve, you've worn a lot of hats and you continue to do it. In the next 30 odd minutes, I'd love to dig deeper and talk to Steve, who is a user experience expert and the author in you. Shall we?
Let's go for it.
All right. So, Steve, you've been practicing user-centric design and research for over 2 decades now. Could you quickly talk to us about your journey and how you've seen this whole field change over the last 2 decades? Has it evolved or devolved? How has it happened?
Evolved or devolved. I love that. Sure. So quickly about me, 20 years ago, there was no UX, there was no web, or it was just starting to be a thing. Mm-hmm. I came out of academia. I was in human computer interaction was kind of my field, which was, I started off in computer science, but mm-hmm. I discovered HCI, as we called it. And that was, a part of making computers that had to do with people, which blew my mind that was actually, an area of practice or an area of scholastic thought, I guess. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn about design. I didn't know board design or the field of design until fairly late in the game, I guess. And I came out of graduate school with a degree in HCI, which turned out at that time didn't actually prepare you to do anything. And I was very lucky to get a job at a consulting business that did industrial design. You know, they made 3D goods, electronic goods. They helped be consulted on the design of those things. Mm-hmm. They had a practice in ethnography. That was sort of the label that was being used. Nice. They had a practice in designing user interfaces. And so all these things that were kind of going on were still, I mean, industrial design was well established. Applied ethnography, brand new. Human interface design was brand new as sort of, you know, professions. Mm-hmm. So I was in sort of an apprentice mode, but it was interesting when you think about people apprenticing, it's kind of when the discipline is long established and there's people that know what they're doing and they kind of pass that knowledge on. Mm-hmm. We were really just figuring it out in the 90s, in the mid to late 90s. And I think you should ask this other part of the question, how has the field evolved? And I think in those early days, there was low awareness. There was low interest. Mm-hmm. Why would you do anything this way? So through a lot of advocacy and, you know, for the company I was working with, sales, they were just, you know, writing articles and giving presentations and trying mm-hmm. to drive some awareness. I think that led to maybe a second stage, which I would say is a mixture of excitement around the possibility of here of this, but also there was a sense of threat. There was some hostility that the changing how you were doing things to bring, you know, people in and ask them questions, like that seemed very threatening, I think, to the long established mode where, you know, the engineer or the designer was sort of gifted with the skills to be able to make these decisions, and the idea that you would introduce these other factors was I think kind of threatening. Mm-hmm. I think that evolved to another era where people started to agree that this was necessary, that you can't make things for people without including some input from them into the process. Mm-hmm. But I think you still started to see that the practice was not really going beyond evaluative, that there was sort of the baseline goal was to make something usable. Mm-hmm. And usable is not a bad thing. It's just sort of, it's only one part of it.
Right.
And so, you know, something like innovative was a term that started to get thrown around. But really that was something that you saw at a conference or a case study that a large agency would put together or get a story placed in the media. That idea of actually doing something that way was still very far out. And I think now, you know, a lot of these methods, I guess we're talking about a couple of things. One is the objective of the research or why you would do it or the receptiveness to it. And mm-hmm. along with that is like what methods are there and how do we do them?
Right.
I think it's much more widely adopted now. It's almost a de facto practice. But what I think also has happened is that it's become commoditized. So in the early days when it was special and people were afraid of it or didn't know what it was, mm-hmm. there was a sense of its uniqueness. And I do fear the commoditization, that it becomes sort of a something you do by rote. You know, you go get your users, you check out your jobs to be done, you check this off, whatever. There's a lot of jargon that gets kind of tossed out, and with that, there's just sort of a sense of this is a by the numbers thing. Hmm. And so I think there's still more to do. I don't think we've gotten to the best state, but you can definitely see the progress along the way. And I think there's probably more to be said around, as web technologies have evolved, a lot of the work is, we have data scientists involved in looking at large quantities of data. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a way to do that a long time ago. We didn't have a need for that. We didn't have the people. We didn't have the tools. So we have a lot more information. And I think one of the good things I see now is, the idea of insights or information that's going to influence a decision comes from a lot of different sources and a lot of different specialties. And I think in a lot of companies, there's really good collaboration across that. So there's not maybe an us and them that we would have had in the olden times. There is a sense of everybody coming together around what information we have to drive decisions.
Right. That's an interesting timeline. So from awareness to a kind of mixture of excitement and hostility to, yeah, the use of innovation, and today the kind of evolution you talked about in terms of why it's being used and the tools being used. It's a pretty interesting timeline that I kind of started to draw here as you started to speak about this. So in this evolution, you talked about hostility and then slowly the practice starting to step in. Today, I think there is an atmosphere, like you kind of rightly put, of possibility of commoditization. And I see a lot of people talk about problem space, solution space. And, you know, especially when it comes to products specifically, people talk about, you know, try to focus on the problem space. You are delving too much into the solution space. How do you see the two of these spaces, so to speak? And maybe if you can quickly talk about that.
Yeah, I see this as well. And there's a talk that I've been giving this year that actually is right along these lines. In this talk, I look at three different approaches. Mm-hmm. One is to focus on solutions. One is to know the problem. And the third is to understand people. I think we have to be careful about being too dogmatic that this is good or this is bad, because I think you see success stories in any one of these approaches, and it's almost like we need to be a little more sensitive to what it takes to be successful in these different approaches. So maybe you can just go through those three to try to answer your question here.
Yeah.
If you look at solution thinking, I think Apple, of course, is an example of that. The thing that they make is the thing that and we could debate these, but it's just a framework. So, right. Beyond Apple, though, Dyson with the, you know, the vacuum cleaner and all their other products. And, you know, the Dyson legend is about how he iterated his solution, 587 times, some huge number, mm-hmm. Till he got it right. But you also have really, less successful examples of what I'm calling solution thinking, like the Segway, that transportation scooter that was going to change the world. And it's this amazing solution to a problem that we don't really have. And so that's why you see it in shopping malls as a security vehicle or by tourists. And, you see things that I think if you think about the solution too much, only there's a tendency to make what I'm calling kind of inventions or invention-y things that are kind mm-hmm. of gadgets that they might just speak to the solution. They maybe don't solve it, or there's kind of an unsatisfying or an elegant way. So I think there's some risks in solution. There are successes, but not everyone can accomplish what Dyson can do or what Apple can do. Mm-hmm. If you look at problem-oriented thinking, I think that also has some shortcomings or some limitations. There's different types of problems. There's the whole simple, complex, wicked problem. What I see among UX especially is this desire to look at these more elusive problems, that's where we should be spending our time as a practice. So fixing democracy or homelessness. Mm-hmm. And of course, these are important. These are problems that we all face in different parts of the world. And of course, it's very valiant to be addressing them. But it's interesting to me that the bar is still pretty low for our basic problems, like basic interaction design problems. Mm-hmm. How are you going to enter a phone number? How are you going to do something? Maybe there's best practices, but we don't see those implemented. And, if you go on Twitter and you follow the hashtag WTFUX, or sucky UX is another one. Mm-hmm. You see where we're at today with, interaction design implementations. And it's still pretty bad. So that says to me that, just looking at the problem is still maybe not enough. There's still kind of other things. Mm-hmm. If you look around your world every day, where as you go around the world, you see, here's one thing I always see is printed out signs that explain how to do something. Mm-hmm. So I went to the movies yesterday, and they had a touch screen that you could use. It was like basically like a giant iPad to mm-hmm. basically order your tickets there. And it didn't work. So we went to where there was a person in front of, there was a staff person in front of a register, mm-hmm. a cash register. And we interacted with them verbally. And then it was one of these movie theaters where you could pick your seats. And so they end up showing you on a special screen that's right in front of you a seat map. Here's all the seats. And there's a sign stuck to the monitor itself that says, this is not a touch screen. And so the woman you know, says, what seats do you want? Here's the map. And then she says, this is not a touch screen. And despite that, it was this beautiful map, and you know, all the seats were like about the size of your finger. I so badly wanted to touch it. So you've got this sign that says this is not a touch screen, and you've got a staff person trained to tell you it's not a touch screen. And that's kind of fixing the problem, but they're kind of fixing the wrong problem. Like, right. It desperately needs to be a touch screen. Everything about how we use information and how we interact with things tells us this should be a touch screen. So just putting a sign up doesn't really fix the problem. So, you know, I think problem space is risky because you have to look at the right problem. And so just the third one here, I think both solution and problem thinking are about us, right? It's about what do we think? What do we want to do? What do we know? And I think there's this real power to looking outside, to just making it not about us, to looking at people without a presumption as to what issues they have, to try to understand them openly. And so if you can do that, I think that takes humility. That takes the beginner's mind. Right. But to seek to understand someone else, then I think the great thing about that is the opportunities to make new things, to change how they go about their day or how they work. Those opportunities emerge very strongly. And it's not trivial, of course, to just – I'm not saying, oh, just go look at people. Right. It is very intentional, and it's very intense. But I think if you have the mindset that people are the experts in their own lives, which is, you know, a bit of a phrase we hear over and over again, but to think about it that way, I think starting with that as a belief, you know, you're asking, how do you get to that point of view? If we say, well, you know, our customers, our users, they're the experts. I think that can be a way to kind of guide us to looking at them and making it about people and not about problems or solutions, but really about starting with people.
Beautiful. I mean, that's a nice way of putting that. I kind of like the people angle that you bring in there. So interesting. So let's probably delve a little bit into something that I heard you talk about recently, or not recently, but then I saw this video of yours that you, I think, spoke in 2012, where you have those nice pictures of the Muscle Beach and Arnold Schwarzenegger and all those things. And you talk about muscle building there. And it resonated with me so much that, you know, the way I kind of look at this whole product mindset in the show here, what are these muscles that you think one should focus on in building user-centric products that we talk about today?
Yeah. Okay. I have a few, and I'll just give a quick explanation for each as to what I think they're about. One is listening, and listening is not, when we're children, we're taught listening is, you know, keeping your mouth shut, right? Mm-hmm. Not talking when someone else is, a mouth shut, ears open. But the listening that we need to do is obviously is much richer than that. And, you know, you hear phrases like active listening, you know, and it's what you're doing in this conversation. I like how you, every question you ask connects back to what we just talked about. And, you know, that's, you're modeling a good interview right now, just through providing signals. You know, so there's a lot of tactics that you can use to be a better listener, to ask questions in a certain way. And even that is maybe surprising to people. Asking questions is a form of listening. Mm-hmm. When you're, whether you're in a meeting or whether you're doing research with an end user or with a teammate, whatever you are, when you say, you know, I want to go back to something you said before, or let me follow up on that. That's a question, but that question is rooted deeply in you listening. Like, what they're saying is influencing what you're doing, and then you're telling them that you're making a feedback loop. So that's listening at kind of this expert level. And that's not natural, right? That's not necessarily what we learn to do in our social settings. We don't listen like that when we're at dinner with our friends or when we're talking with our family. So this is a, you know, an area to develop. It's a muscle to be built. Mm-hmm. Synthesis is another one, I think. And that's, I mean, it really goes with analysis, right? Analysis is breaking things down into smaller pieces. And synthesis is building those smaller pieces up into something new. So an example for that is, here's a thing that I like to complain about when people describe doing user research and they say, so I interviewed this person and then I came back and I wrote up my insights. And I always feel like, no, the insights don't come from the quotes or even the realizations you have with a single interview. The insights are the result of taking a whole body of information, breaking it down, and then building it up into something new. And that doesn't happen on an interview by interview. That happens mm-hmm. kind of on a project or at a larger scale. So that ability to build up into something new, a new belief, a new problem statement, a new understanding, a new point of view, that's, I think, is really important. Storytelling. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I need to say too much about that. I think just stories are a way of communicating things. Design solutions. We see this in like scenarios as kind of a, you know, user interface design technique. Communicating with other people, using the products we make as stories that are going to be out there in the world that or the people can tell stories with and tell stories about. I think there's just so much tied to storytelling. Mm-hmm. Maybe one last one would be divergent thinking. And so, you know, maybe you come across this phrase, how might we? Right. When you have a point of view about how something could be different, there's a difference between saying, well, how should we or how will we solve this? And just saying, how might we solve it? And inviting people to create many, many different ideas, because ideas are cheap, right? I mean, you can come up with many ideas very quickly. It doesn't mean that you are choosing to do those things. You're just choosing to generate them. Right. And that really freeing, it's a very free and freeing activity to think divergently. Like, what are all the different ways that are possible here? You get to different solutions than if you just say, well, what should we do? How can we fix this? It's that how might we thing, I think, is a really, you know, everyone can do it. They just need to be sort of given permission to do that. And
right.
Yeah, I think those are my four muscles that I would emphasize.
Neat. So you talk about listening, synthesis, storytelling, and divergent thinking. You know, I actually, for some reason, want to go back to this point that you made early on about the fear of commoditization that you talked about. Yeah. Now, talking about these, I mean, in this presentation, you had actually listed down, I think, seven different muscles, and you talked about four of them. So my question here probably is this. First of all, what kind of commoditization do you fear? In the sense, would it become like you do these, you learn these seven different things, seven different muscles, and you become a user experience or user research expert? Is that the commoditization or something else?
I'd say these muscles are a way to, you know, building these muscles works against commoditization. Someone that can do these things and is getting better at doing these things is, I think, very special and brings a lot of value to their team. Mm-hmm. The commoditization, I think, is maybe less in the practitioners of user research. Well, it's a little bit. It's more in the, the stakeholders, the people that act on user research.
Got it.
Where it's a checkbox. And where the power of insights, of research, of new perspectives on people to create new things or to make the things that we were going to put out in the world special and impactful. I think we can do so much more than we're getting to do or that people think we're there to do. So yeah, researchers that can, that are great at storytelling, or researchers, designers, you know, it's a process that we're going through to bring this information in. If you can listen deeply, if you can synthesize into new things and tell stories and facilitate, then you are really pushing, the process of user research and insights to its potential to really drive change and create wonderful things. versus, you know, saying, well, what do you want to see different in this product? Okay, got it, got it, got it. Okay, everyone, the three things we need to put in our product are this, this, and this. Right. Like, that's a commoditizing behavior. Mm. And so if we don't do that, if we do something richer, then we start to push against commoditization and show how much value we are bringing into the process.
Beautiful. That's really nice, because I've been asked this question multiple times about what is this difference between market research and user research. And I think a lot of companies try to do market research and think they've done user research and try to use that data to make a lot of decisions in terms of, I mean, product decisions. So hence was my question, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. So let's move on here. We've talked about user research quite a bit now, or rather started talking about it. So there was a post that I had written a week back, and you know, you commented on it. It was titled Getting to Why, but then there was this comment that you put that I really wanted you to expand on. I think people would find a lot of value in it. You said the question you ask and the question you want to get an answer to, the two of them are very different.
Yeah.
So can you expand on that?
Yeah. You know, I think it's kind of like that example I just modeled where you ask people for their feature request and then you go and report on that. And that's a naive way of doing research, that our job is to just sort of scoop up statements from people. You know, you need to understand what are the most important features in a proposed design, but that doesn't mean that you ask someone what features are the most important to you. You have to be able to answer the question, but that doesn't mean that you ask it. Right. So you have to have some interaction with your participants in user research that gives you confidence that you know the answer. But it doesn't mean you just ask them the question. And that's really the art, right? You know, depending on what our topic is, how are we going to drive a whole conversation? How are we going to plan for it so we understand, you know, which statements we have that they make that we have confidence in? We understand why we get their background. Not just to build rapport and be friendly, but because it provides context for their opinions and their critiques later on in the interview. We understand when they say, I like this, I want this, I've used this, I wouldn't use that. We understand a little bit more why that is because we've got a larger sense. So the job of the researcher is to figure out, how am I going to be able to answer this question? What am I going to ask in order to give me the confidence that I have that answer, rather than just capturing quotes that sort of tally up to a conclusion.
Right. Beautiful. So, Steve, you talked about synthesis. We just started talking about questions here. So I have one question which is like related to the two of this, perhaps. Mm. You know, when it comes to, you know, conducting, you know, user interviews, you know, the most common advice I've been given a lot of times, and I all right, I hope you've been enjoying this, listening to this conversation and all the interesting thing that Steve had to talk about. Now, the first and the foremost thing that I really want you to think about is the third perspective that he brings to the whole problem space versus solution space thinking. Now, that's the people space, or I don't know, he just calls it people. Now, the one angle that really comes to my mind when he talks about people is the whole approach that the jobs to be done framework or the jobs to be done theory talks about. And we had Karen Dillon on the show just some time back in episodes 112 and 113, where she talks about jobs to be done, and which basically says, think about what jobs people are trying to get done and focus on helping them get the jobs done. Now, that's almost what Steve talks about with the people angle to it. Now, there is more to it, but then I'm just trying to strike an analogy and a parallel here. Now, that's a very important point. And also, he lists down four different things that he calls as the muscles that you need to kind of work upon in order to get your user experience or UX thinking kind of right. The first one is listening. Second is synthesis. Storytelling, that's the third one. And the last one is divergent thinking. Now, there are more muscles that he talks about. I'll have the link to that blog post or that video in the show notes. And also, I'd love for you to think about these muscles, because ultimately, I think what we are trying to strive for in this podcast and in all these conversations that I've had so far is, how do we try to understand or get to the bare minimal muscles or skill sets or mindsets, as I call it, to be good at making user-centric products, trying to build products that users love. All right, that's all I really have for today. I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I really, really hope you go look up that video where Steve talks about these muscles and the muscle beach. And I really hope you give this a real thought and let me know what you think. If you really like this angle where Steve talks about people, let us know. Go head over to designyourthinking.com/episode120 to leave a comment or tweet the episode, and we can chat on Twitter as well. All right, that's all I have for today. If you really enjoyed listening to this episode, please do subscribe to the podcast, because the second part of this episode is also going to come out in a couple of days from now, and I just don't want you to miss that out, because there are a bunch of different interesting topics that Steve talks about, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy that one. So just head over to designyourthinking.com/iTunes if you're using an Apple device, or head over to designyourthinking.com/Stitcher if you're using an Android device. Just do that and follow the cues, subscribe to the show, and yeah, if possible, I really would appreciate if you could leave me a rating and review. That's all I have for today. If you enjoy listening to these episodes, and of course, if you've subscribed to the show, do subscribe to my newsletter by heading over to designyourthinking.com/insider. I have my two ebooks, The 30-Day Product Mission and The Tiny Book of Triggers, waiting for you right there. Until I see you with the next episode, stay tuned, stay inspired, keep pushing, my friend. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Design Your Thinking podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at www.designyourthinking.com.